some of you have inquired about the material I'm using, and you may be interested in knowing that I'm taking just a little bit from the Division of Congregational Life's material on parish social ministry, and it's this notebook, which is about the 11th draft, called Congregational Social Ministry Consultative Planning Process, 1991. So if you're interested in these kinds of materials, come up after the session and get the reference. I don't know if this is available for wide distribution. What the ELCA is attempting to do is, in each synod across the country, to have congregations begin going through a process of dealing with social ministry. And so they are working with each synod in identifying congregations to go through a process of study, reflection, action. And what I'm doing here is just taking their methodology on the scriptural part. There's other parts to it that this process uses. And the process, in essence, that the scriptural does is to reflect on the biblical stories to see what the experiences of the biblical people are in relationship to God and to one another, and then connect the congregation story and the people within the congregation story and the people from the community. Bring the different stories together, and out of that process emerges understanding and opportunities for applying the call to love and share and justice within the congregation and in the community. So I'm attempting to use this, and while I've dealt with these kinds of things in many ways over the last 25 or 30 years, this is, for me, somewhat of a new application. Looking upon the Bible text, not so much for exegetical reasons and, so forth, but more from a story learning perspective. So that's what I'm trying to do here, and I really appreciated yesterday and the day before those of you that shared your own story or insights, because that's what I think makes this beneficial, and that's what they're attempting to do. If we were doing this in your congregation, we would give you the text, talk a little bit about it, but you would break into small groups, 6-7 people, and talk about the biblical story, and then each of you would share your own experiences, and out of that, action would take place. And action can be interpreted very widely. So today, we'll talk about relationship and justice, and I want to reflect on a passage from Prophet Hosea, and then connect that to a part of the Sermon on the Mount, and then integrate that a little bit with our own experiences in relationships, and finally to bring in some of Matt Fox's material, which applies this to some degree. It says basically the same thing. So maybe we could begin in a meditative way for a couple of minutes. Close your eyes and reflect on your own relationship with others, especially the times when you were alienated from a loved one, or you were experiencing alienation from your community, or maybe your church. reflect a little bit on one or two of your experiences that were poignant in your life. Then you might want to think of your relationship with God. The times that you were perhaps alienated from God, or felt at least alienated from God, and how that impacted you. The passage I'd like to work with today is the fourth chapter of Hosea, verses 1 to 19. Somebody like to volunteer to read
the
that?
The Lord has an accusation to bring against the people. He said 4, 1 to 19.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Who live in this land. Listen, Israel, to what he says. There is no faithfulness or love in the land, and people do not acknowledge me as God. They make promises and break them. They lie, murder, steal, and commit adultery. Crimes increase, and there is one murder after another. And so the land will dry up, and everything that lives on it will die. All the animals and birds, and even the fish, will die. The Lord says, let no one accuse the people or reprimand them. My complaint is against you priests. Night and day you blunder on, and the prophets do no better than you. I am going to destroy Israel, your mother. My people are doomed because they do not acknowledge me. You priests have refused to acknowledge me and have rejected my teaching, and so I reject you and will not acknowledge your sons as my priests. The more of you priests there are, the more you sin against me, and so I will turn your honor into disgrace. You grow rich from the sins of my people, and so you want them to sin more and more. You will suffer the same punishment as the people. I will punish you and make you pay for the evil you do. You will eat your share of sacrifices and still be hungry. You will worship the fertility gods but still have no children because you have turned away from me to follow other gods. The Lord says, wine, both old and new, is robbing my people of their senses. They ask for revelations from a piece of wood, a stick, tells them what they want to know. They have left me. Like a woman who becomes a prostitute, they have given themselves to other gods. At sacred places and on the mountaintops, they offer sacrifices, and on the hills, they burn incense under tall, spreading trees because the shade is so pleasant. As a result, your daughters serve as prostitutes, and your daughters-in-law commit adultery. Yet I will not punish them for this because you yourselves go off with temple prostitutes, and together with them, you offer pagan sacrifices. As the proverb says, a people without sense will be ruined. Even though you people of Israel are unfaithful to me, may Judah not be guilty of the same thing. Don't worship at Gilgal and the Thaven, or make promises there in the name of the living God. The people of Israel are as stubborn as mules. How can I feed them like lambs in the meadow? The people of Israel are under the spell of idols. Let them go their own way. After drinking much wine, they delight in their prostitution, preferring disgrace to honor. They will be carried away as by the wind, and they will be ashamed of their pagan sacrifices.
Would anyone like to give a stab at what the prophet is saying about relationship to God, to the people?
It sounds like the people were trying to, I think the word is syncretism, trying to incorporate the culture around them and the outside influences of their long-standing covenant into their lives.
Mm-hmm. Being subverted from the outside.
Mm-hmm.
affecting their relationship to God and choosing the outside influences.
I think it's interesting that he's targeting the priests.
Powerfully,
the
isn't he?
Yeah. Yeah.
The leaders.
The leadership, yeah.
Verses 1 to 3, I think, are pivotal here. Hear the word of the Lord, O people of Israel, for the Lord has an indictment against the inhabitants of the land. There is no faithfulness or loyalty and no knowledge of God to the land. He's saying, what I hear him saying is, no knowledge of God. And what I understand knowledge to be in the Hebrew mentality is experience. It's a breaking of the relationship by not experiencing God, by not embracing God.
Certainly sounded like today, lie, murder, steal, commit adultery, crimes increase, one murder after another.
Mm-hmm.
In a community that's not worried about that.
Mm-hmm. I think the next verse sounds like today too.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
You talk about planet Earth and what's happening to planet Earth. It's
in this version, they say, therefore the land mourns. I think that's an interesting way of describing it. The land is weeping, the land is crying.
It is, isn't it? Yeah. As though the land and just realizes that there's an alienation, a powerful alienation taking place. And,
yeah.
And all I can do is cry about it and feel bad.
It'd be like walking from here to a Safeway parking lot. You get the sense the parking lot is weeping.
There was some mention of this being addressed to the priest, and that recalled to me earlier this week in another session with another the session was regarding a priesthood of all believers, and the scripture that says we rise from our baptism, Luther said it too, all ordained as priests before the Lord. I'm paraphrasing.
So it's not right and just to point
I
to...
I think we need to be very cautious about tapping the buck and saying
right.
It's just believers, because the first verse in chapter 4 is, hear the word of the Lord, O people of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And then later when it's a mention of priests, I think we could connect that to the New Testament and consider that we are all priests. It's all of us.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me, the report is... has to do with the teaching of the population or the witness to, are the ones who are being paid are the ones who know better, who have revelation or knowledge and have not shared it.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically in this text, the complaint in verse 2 is, and that's the Ten Commandments. Everything listed there has to do with the commandments of Moses, and if you know God, then you live this way. And they're not living that way, how come? The implication seems to be because they've been taught.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know if that's true or not, but that seems to be. But I don't blame you folks. You don't know. It's you guys who should know better, witness better, live better, teach better.
So we all, by baptism, have a very intentional relationship to God. And we all have a responsibility for that. But, you know, the leaders, there's a tension, you know, between the newly elect and so forth, and leaders. So I would hate to be simplistic and blame everything on the priest too, today or then. But of course, you know, the priests hold themselves up and are held up as... But what I understand this to be getting at is the state of alienation that takes place is based on fracturing of our relationship to God. And then sin follows from that. You know.
I see him describing two types of alienation here. There's in the early parts, he's talking about killing, stealing, adultery, alienation, relationships between people.
Mm-hmm.
And toward the later verses here, he's talking about alienation in worship and sacrifices and cult prostitutes and the things that were not part of the Hebrew religion. So there's two alienations, alienation with God and alienation with fellow men.
And I think that's real important, because how do those two alienations or sets of relationships combine or relate? You know, what follows from our alienation from God? What follows from our alienation or experience with one another? We're trying to get at an idea of the biblical concept of justice here. And what is justice?
On the prior point too, I'm RSV, and unlike the Good News, which is read, priest is singular rather than plural in the RSV. Mm-hmm. With the footnote that the Greek, that the Hebrew is unclear, but it seems like the import could be to the nation as a whole, which is supposed to be a priest to the world, not mm-hmm. just the priest within Israel, but mm-hmm. Israel as a nation, which is supposed to be a priest to the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a whole other.
Yeah.
Relationship, you know.
But all the priests is singular in the RSV, and that you have to
I'm trying to find the priest here. I reject you from being a priest to me.
That sounds like a word of the nation to me.
Yeah, it sounds like that to me too. You have forgotten the law of your God. I also forget your children. He's talking to the nation.
Especially as you read through that the worst state to the northern kingdom is being forsaken.
Mm-hmm. The interpretation put on by the DCL people is that sin is the alienation from God, the state of alienation that individuals and groups, nations choose, and that the sinful actions are a result of that. And this appears different to a lot of popular understanding about sin. Popular understanding is, I commit adultery, God sees me and punishes me. You know, you've done wrong. You know, alienation takes place from a sinful action. Whereas this seems to be saying, I choose to ignore God, ignore my relationship to God, and go elsewhere. And then sinful actions, adultery, stealing, covetousness, greed, take place. Verses 11 to 13 are supposed to be pretty indicative. Wine and new wine take away the understanding. My people consult a piece of wood, and their divining rod gives them oracles. For a spirit of whoredom has led them astray, and they have played the whore, forsaking their God. They sacrifice on the top of the mountains and make offerings upon the hills, under oak, poplar, terebinth, because their shade is good. Consequence of ignoring the relationship to the God the covenant was with, and they choose other gods to relate to. In the New Testament, this is brought together in the Sermon on the Mount when Christ is talking about taking your gifts to the altar. Take your gift to the altar. And if you realize that somebody has a complaint against you, that something is wrong, before bringing your gift to the altar, you go address that person that's got the complaint against you, and then bring your gifts to the altar. And that's where the two sets of relationships are brought together, the relationship to God and the relationship to our fellow human beings. I'd like to bring in Matthew Fox here from his book Spirituality Named Compassion. And he talks about this reality, and I could graphically show it. And it gets into the practical application in Western Christianity. He states, "We have seen how Jose Miranda demonstrated that this betrayal happened in Western religion with the very words mercy and justice. Originally, Safat meant justice, and the just God was the one on the side of the unjustly oppressed." I'll graph this later on so it'll make more sense. The unjustly oppressed, the poor, the widow, and the orphan. He talks about a vertical relationship to God in the form of a ladder. As the ladder grew in influence and power, the very name of God as justice was altered to God as judge. Instead of standing with the poor, God became judge over the poor, aligned with the powerful at the top of the ladder. The poor could no longer call on God as a steadfast partner in justice making, but had to appeal to mercy, which became a buffer between the God of judgment and the simple non-privileged people. Thus appeals to mercy and to the God of mercy, in fact, accepted and encouraged the status quo. Mercy became a tender feeling, but had nothing to do with changing structures or liberating people. Compassion then became synonymous with mercy, and the word justice was exiled into introverted areas of religious concern about one's righteousness before God. How far God talk wandered from the biblical tradition of God as warrior on behalf of the oppressed, of God waging war for the slaves and the forgotten, of justice of what people need to crave instead of what a final judgment meets out to the powerless. The true meaning of Safat is not to judge, but rather to do justice to the weak and oppressed. Compassion becomes the carving of justice, which is often as assertive, an assertive kind of work, as in Psalm 143, "In his compassion, he destroys my enemies." Those who remain close to the earth may be farther from the judges who preside so handsomely from on high, but they live more closely to the justice which comes from below and which alone is a divine name. What Fox and with him Jose Miranda, a Latin American biblical scholar, are saying, trying to say, is that God is identified with us, with the poor, and that it became a misuse of the word judge and justice, Safat, to say that God is judge instead of God being with us in fighting for justice and what is right. And Fox graphs this as a ladder. And earlier in the book, he talks about Jacob's ladder. It's a vertical relation. A vertical relationship to God, which is essentially a competitive type thing, but I don't want to get into that too much. But here is God as judge. And we have the poor here. And in between is the buffer, mercy. Poor asking God's mercy, a very individualistic type of relationship to God.
What do you mean by the poor here?
Pardon me?
What do you mean by the poor here?
The widows, the orphans. This is, you know, a biblical thing. The widow, the orphan, the alien.
Sojourner.
Aliens in a strange land, right. Stand for people in our society, maybe people with AIDS, maybe some of the minorities.
Children.
Children.
Those without access to power, right, just by definition.
Without
those
what?
Those who are cut off from the power structures and have no access.
Well, that's my understanding, yeah.
Then where are those who do not regard themselves in that category, where are they in this ladder? Are we the ones showing mercy? Or are we included
in
among
in this ladder, this is One way of looking at justice. Now I was going to present another way, the biblical way we're trying to come up with here. And, you know, the ruling elite is often put here, connected, you know, to God, often identified with God, sometimes the church elite, sometimes the government or military elite, the people that have an oppressive relationship to the poor. What they're trying to get at is the Hosea's concept of justice, which is God is here with the poor fighting their battles, and mercy takes on a new meaning with justice of making right the conditions of the poor. This is what the bottom line is in this passage with Hosea is God is working with us. He's fighting the battles of making the relationships among people, right? That old, going back to the Sermon on the Mount with Christ, said if you got a problem with your neighbor, or your neighbor has a problem with you, set it right. And that affects your relationship with God. So where are we who are not materially poor is what you're asking, and it depends on our relationship with God and our neighbor. Are we trying to
consider myself poor in spirit?
Poor in spirit,
and that makes the left one pretty harsh.
Mm-hmm.
Because if God is continually judging, I'm always looking through mercy to being judged perpetually because I am poor in spirit. That's pretty frightening. You sense you didn't make it.
This path to buy wine thing. So, but there, it's a condition of being very, like you said, poor in spirit. You know, and this, they turned away from God. I mean, I think being, you could be very poor and still have a lot of money, not monetarily poor, but you could have a lot of money and still be in a poor
spirit. Talk about poor in spirit.
Yeah.
Let's not try to be too literal, but it is a struggle between actual poverty and being right with God and our neighbor and those who have money. It goes to that saying where Christ was approached and by the young man and who was rich, and the young man kept all the commandments, and Christ said, "Want to really follow me? Give away your goods and come follow me." The young man couldn't, and Christ said, "How hard it is for the rich to get to heaven, but with God anything is possible." So there is a real tension there, but it's not impossible.
I think we need to go back to the focus you gave us at the beginning. We're talking about justice here. We're talking about justice for the poor, however we define them. It's going to be us sometimes, it's going to be others. But primarily, it's those that are oppressed by our system, whether that's church or state or wherever it is, people who are oppressed. And then the folks at the top are saying, well, we can oppress you because God is with us and not with you. And so the relation, the folks at the top, the relationship with God is misused. And for the people at the bottom, it's exceedingly harsh. And it doesn't matter whether I feel poor in spirit now and it's exceedingly harsh on me, or someone else goes through life as one of those we mentioned as poor. Justice is what we're after. And how do we...
The concept of justice.
And the biblical prophetic concept of justice is, I think, reflected in that passage. It says, what does the Lord require of you but to act justly, to love mercy, and walk humbly with your Lord. Mm-hmm. And that's the key concept of justice, I think you're saying, which is the one Jose is getting at, which is the biblical concept, which is in contrast to what church history has sometimes
presented.
Yeah.
To act justly, what does that mean?
Right.
I think you're very helpful. The relationship idea is what I'm trying to stress here. It's a relational thing more than an actual act-by-act thing. Justice is a right relationship.
I think that's what quote on the Supreme Court building, Joey's finding quite interesting. I think it's from Hosea, and I just couldn't find it here. I think that quote is from Hosea. I can't remember if it's Hosea 6 or Hosea 7.
What quote is that?
That quote, I think, is from Hosea. What does the Lord require of you but to act justly, to love mercy? But I think it's interesting, the first part of that's on the Supreme Court building, so even at our founding, we still were tied up with the biblical concept of justice. But somehow in the everyday, day-to-day, it often doesn't get translated that way.
No, there's a whole centuries of tradition, pointing to our individualistic acts, as being sinful, as opposed to, what's our basic orientation? What's our basic posture in life? Is it toward God or is it toward, the material world or some other false god? Bert?
Seems to me that the quote on the Supreme Court is exactly the contrary. It's an indication of the fact that somewhere along the line, we as a people and other nations decided to leave the mercy of God as a way of relating to other people, and become instead a people of rules, of laws. And if you kept the rule, no matter what its consequences were, you were found innocent or proper by the law, even though it might grind horribly on populations or people in the population. On the other hand, if you regard instead of talking about, argue with my son now, instead of arguing about the Ten Commandments, think of the Decalogue as being ten principles by which God blesses people in their life, rather than law, rather than command. If you think, for example, about the rule of the word that you are a happier and more just person, you don't covet. Nothing could be further from a law than don't covet, because covet doesn't even require an act. It's purely a thought. I've spent my life as a lawyer. If you think of justice as being compliance with the rule, then you may have great amounts of alienation resulting precisely from the rule. The rule, the law, justice in its common usage in our society is an indication of our real poverty, because we've decided we cannot live with each other in love and in brotherhood and the kind of thing that Hosea is talking about. And in order to escape that, what we see as being too difficult, a lifestyle of living in love with each other and willingness to be at the bottom of the of your ladder over there, instead of God as the servant, we've decided to make God and all that God said and what we choose to call the commandments at the top. And then in order to live with that at all, we've decided that justice now means compliance with the rule that the legislature or that some judge and precedent has given to us.
That's right.
And if we've complied with that statement, we think ourselves holy, even though the consequences is utterly destructive of somebody.
Exactly.
There ain't no way that law ever operates except to decide an argument between two people, buyer, seller, landlord, tenant, and so forth, down to the long line. One wins, one loses. That's poverty. With God, it's a win-win. But in order to do that, we have to stop thinking about right and wrong in our common
ordinary.
Our common usage. And get back to what I sense you're getting at, you're doing a beautiful job of it. And that is, justice doesn't mean compliance with the rule. The daughter, the harlot, and so forth, these people are not condemned. They're loved. Even though they're a long, long way away from the rules of Israel. That's because somewhere there we converted that whole notion of love over into a set of principles. Do this, you got to obey, no matter what the consequences are.
I think that was outstanding. Does that connect with what you were saying?
Yeah, right. But I just always hope that even under our American system and whatever, that we have, that even though judges and so forth are handing down decisions in regard to specific laws, that there is this standard that we can throw back to, the biblical standard of this justice and mercy, so that the letter of the law can be tempered by the spirit of mercy. And I think there are situations in which, you know, judges will look at the mitigating circumstances. The decision has been made, but then they can decide in their mercy to set aside this decision, or, you know, take other things into account, which looks at a broader spirit of the whole concept of justice than the rulemaking thing.
I don't want to monopolize conversation, but think of what you just said. The last thing that you want legally is a judge who decides what she or he thinks is right in her or his own mind. That means that the judge can look what the legislature has said or what precedent has said and what we've built our lives believing is something we can live with, i.e. legally. And the judge said, oh, well, I don't like the consequences of what the rule of law does here, so I, as a judge, will now do what I think is right. God saved me from the judge who is not bound by law.
How do you come
to that? Because a judge acts violently. Mm-hmm. Law is always violent. Mm-hmm. The last analysis, you send out the sheriff. Mm-hmm. To take away the farm, or to put you in jail, or deprive you of life, liberty, or
right.
the pursuit of happiness. Right. On the other hand, what Hosea is talking about, as I see it, is we're not bound by that kind of thing, and we may act in love because we never act as Christians violently. Nothing that Jesus ever did was finally enforced by violence. Always there is that freedom. And that I can live with. As long, I can love a Christian as long as they don't come at me with a club.
Right.
And that's the exact opposite of what the sheriff does. We need the sheriff. Don't misunderstand me. I'm not arguing for chaos. But don't confuse my business as a lawyer
with
anything that
the gospel
that mm-hmm. Hosea is calling justice. Mm-hmm. The word is totally different.
And it's critical. Give an example. Try to come up with what justice means for us as Christians and members of congregations, members of society, and so forth. I work with Lutheran Social Services, and last January we had a board meeting, and part of that board meeting was to talk about the mission of Lutheran Social Services. And we were throwing a lot of different words on the board, but one of the words was justice. And one of the board members said, why should that word be in there, you know, in our mission? And people like me said, that's the word. You know, what we're talking about is correcting the ills of society, making things right and wholesome, making relationships among people right, rich, poor, the sad, and so forth. And drawing that person out, what that person understand justice to mean is what Byrne was saying was, you know, the legalistic concept of justice, not the concept of justice we're talking about here. So language is critical, and we found in our situation a whole need to spend a fair amount of time just defining terms. And most of us come at the word justice from either a strong legalistic sense that we're talking about, or this sense here. So that's why I think BCL, you know, the Lutheran, Evangelical Lutheran Church are trying to say is, let's get close to the biblical concept of justice and so forth. And Miranda, to give you a graphic idea, he comes from Latin America, where, you know, we got a very hierarchical society, and I saw a cartoon in the paper where here's a, you know, the tribunal, okay, the secular tribunal, and you have the military, and you have the government, and you have the church. This is concept in Latin America, and down here are all the poor, the masses. And in Latin America, there's a real struggle going on. The second plate of this was, here's the tribunal again, and here's the military, and here's the government, and here's the poor, and this, what is happening in a lot of places, the church is now down here. Now, granted, this is real simplistic, and nothing's that simplistic in life, but that's the struggle going on in Latin America, where Jose Miranda comes from, and I think in some degrees in our own country. But we're struggling to come up with an understanding of what the biblical meaning of justice is, and to me it appeals a lot to put it in terms of relationship with one another.
Part of my struggle is that I'm one of the elite.
I am too. As a member of this society.
I think we have a pretty basic refusal to kind of grip with that.
Mm-hmm.
With the result that the institutions which support us as elite, we're very reluctant to change.
Mm-hmm.
We're very reluctant to call into question. With the result that all that we do, or so often, the situation doesn't change for the poor, for the widow, for the orphan, for those whom the biblical witness speak to,
mm-hmm.
or speak of as before.
Mm-hmm.
Then because, you know, we in the church, or many of us, are at that place where it says that elite up there.
Mm-hmm.
And we like to say we ought to talk about the government or the church as somehow that is different than us.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and we suffer.
Or the institutions of society or the corporate structures. Hey.
I think what you're saying, though, is the elite suffers too because we are out of sync with what we truly do.
Oh, yeah.
And so we're all hurting, and that's where the relationship and alienation is.
But
so
it's easier to hurt. It's easier to hurt when you have food on the table.
Oh, yes.
You can deal with that much better.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you
but you always haven't had food on your table, too.
What's that?
You haven't always had food on your table. I'm not talking about you personally because I don't know, but my assumption is that there are times in our lives when we're down and oppressed, you know. Some of us are blessed and never had physical oppression, but, you know, we lose a job, but we, you know, whatever.
Well, part of it is you can't tackle it all. From my own world, I'm a school teacher, and I feel very, very strongly that kids, a great many kids, especially at-risk kids, are the oppressed. They're greatly oppressed in the school system. And I feel it's all I can do as a person, not to worry about, the entire world, but to worry about that group of kids, the little people in the school where I am. And I feel some sense of justice in my work, you know, but I'm certainly not taking on the whole world. And maybe that's cowardness on my part or something, but I can just deal with small amounts at a time. For me, for now.
Yeah. That's all you have power to do. You know.
Part of the reality for me, though, is that sort of thing, because I don't buy the second model. Even though I look at the first model, I think, well, if I'm doing justice, I've come a couple rungs down the ladder, and therefore I sacrifice. And so I still work on the first model. So trying to be the church underneath or living justly to me is a personal sacrifice and giving up. So I still think in terms of the ladder. I don't want to be at the bottom of the ladder. I know cognitively that's where I'm supposed to be, but I don't want to be there because I'm one of the elite. And it's not until I guess it's my understanding conversion, I'm over here on the second picture,
mm-hmm.
that
mm-hmm.
this is not a giving up.
Mm-hmm.
It's like she was just saying here. We are all sort of part of it at the top. Until I understand that, and can really embrace that, then it doesn't become a giving up to do justice, but a salvation to do justice. But I can't personally make myself believe that. And the word of Hosea is, well, then, Dave, you get enough with your VCR and your color TVs. And
mm-hmm.
that's the condemnation.
Yeah. I you know, at the session before this, there was a gentleman who literally is trying to give up, you know, not identify with, you know, the elite, have all those things and be part of it. And I think that's a struggle that I go through all the time is, you know, God, I'm pretty middle class and when it comes right down to it. But is that all bad? You know, what are we talking about here? What is an apt sense of justice in our society, in the world we live in? Are we shooting that everybody becomes poor? I don't think that's what we're talking about. I feel we're talking about a better distribution of wealth. You know, the kids you're dealing with, you know, tangibly, with a little work in your community and in this nation, we could get all the kids at a material level that will enable them to grow spiritually as well as materially, you know. And, you see what I'm saying? We have choices to make, but...
We're now becoming poor.
Right.
The elite have got to share their overabundance of resources, whether they be physical or whatever, in a limited situation. So yeah, I'd not advance to become poor, but those of us that have, you know, four times as much as we need, please come down a couple notches. I think, I mean, that's my personal understanding.
But isn't the sharing of the wealth really a manifestation of something else? Of saying to you are my brother, that I care about you, whoever you are, is the precursor, seems to me, then have some of my bread. I think one is just a manifestation. And saying, you know, no, I'm equal with you, you're equal with me.
That's right. This is person to person. You value that person as a person.
I think we'll find each of us has a different way to express it, and each has a different calling. But the calling is to love, and love is expressed in respect. And that's what's missing, whether we're elite or whether we're poor.
Mm-hmm.
But especially those who are underprivileged and at risk and scruffy and hard to love are the ones who most need that respect. And all of us are capable of doing that.
I agree, and I think the word mercy here in this posture of where the judge is up here, God is judge and we're judge, mercy being a buffer between the poor and God, that is what we're trying to, you know, go back to the biblical meaning of mercy over here is working with the needy, your kids or whatever, so that they have a just existence, a just and wholesome existence. Whereas mercy here is, you know, they're always beseeching, they're always in a down position. Give help, 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 you know. And that's what we're trying to, I think, correct by simplifying it with the latter model, is to give people dignity as persons. And the mercy is correcting their circumstances as opposed to having them always postured to ask for forgiveness or ask for help.
And their poorness may have nothing to do with material things. They may be addicted to all sorts of destructive behavior because no one has respected them. It doesn't matter whether their parents are part of the elite or what they are. The kids at risk, at least in our county, come from all across the spectrum, and they're not just what we consider the oppressed poor, although certainly they are there as well. But the only way to get out of that, at least as far as I can see, is to go to the model that love and mercy and mm-hmm. respect and dignity that God gives us that then we give others is the only answer. And it isn't done by some fiat at the top with the elite. It's a person-by-person relationship by relationship.
You mentioned the rich young ruler a little while ago. I think it's a mistake to think that it is not possible for a person to have wealth and to have the love of God. It's just that it's terribly difficult. As Scripture says, it's like passing the camel through the eye of the needle. Not an impossibility, but great difficulty. Reason is that, as it has been said many times, all power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. As one acquires power in any form, whether it's wealth or position or anything else, the tendency to corruption increases with the wealth. So it's very difficult to be one who is defensive of my income or my home or whatever it may be, and to be loving at the same time in the Christian sense. All power corrupts. A temptation to leave the pattern of living as Christian. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. I think if one thinks of justice that way, how difficult it is to be just and to be a rich young lord at the same time. It doesn't mean that one must stop being a rich young lord. It means that one must not be totally corrupted.
Well, and the answer came in the same parable when he said it can't be done without God, and the rich young ruler requires the first relationship with God, and lack of alienation there. And that comes by watching how Jesus handled his power. He gave it away. He empowered the people that came to him, whether they were the rich young ruler or whether they were the oppressed poor.
He empowered. So it's the real good sense of power. You know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, he had a terrible burden. He was rich, he was young, and he was a ruler.
Right.
How can you acquire more power than to be rich, to be young, and to be a ruler?
Mm-hmm.
He had a great problem. The text of two few Sundays ago, as I remember the pastor reading it, was that, maybe you help me out, it was something about, I will totally abolish the law. And the question was whether abolish meant to completely take it out and start over again. I think not. I think that's a corruption of that text. I think it means I will change your way of thinking about the law of God. Abolish the concept that it is law in our modern terminology.
Mm-hmm.
And make it mean the law of God is the law of love.
An invitation then. Not in a book. The invitation to be a Christian ruler was therefore tried by the way. You love your youth, you love your status, your authority, your power. If it's problematic for you, sure it can be done, but if it's problematic, then get rid of it, try it the other way. Or abolish the law. If it adheres to the rules, it's problematic for you. Do a different way. And you can, for some you can do both, but if you can't do both, then the invitation is to unburden yourself.
Does somebody else want this middle seat?
You seem to be handling it well.
One of the problems of having a son like that is if you give up your position as a ruler, if you give up your wealth, try giving up your youth. The way you do it is the person who is born into a world already corrupted by ages of alienation, born in any way except into sin. I love you, sir, for saying that sin is alienation.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that anybody who thinks that sin is the violation of a law, it rocks in his or her head.
Mm-hmm.
But you're born into a world which is already alienated. And part of that alienation may be that you're young and just have power whether you want it or not.
You don't know what you're...
Therefore, you have this constant problem to deal with in some form of temptation.
Mm-hmm.
So deal with it.
Well, thank you for sharing. It's a tough issue to deal with. They're quite a pair.